Akane Tendo pigtailed girl. Akane Tendo pigtailed girl. Akane Tendo pig.
Sometimes we are five, sometimes only one. The mysterious white shadow that steals close to its prey.
Shadow Warriors of Justice, the Saiyan Ninja Team!
Who?
United, we are Gatchaman!
Greetings, programs, and welcome to another Science Patrol-erific, G-Force-tastic episode of Big in Japan, where we talk about anime. And, you know, normally Justin is going to be one of your hosts, but Justin's absent this evening, and I have brought in, I've called my lifeline, a very special guest, and joining me on this call tonight for Big in Japan, by request, is none other than the head cheese at Quad M Productions, TJ Damon. What's up, man? What's going on, dude?
Hello, my friend. How are we doing this fine evening, day, or whatever time people are listening to this?
I'm pretty good. I always tell it like it is. I am good this fine evening. I have my warm, hot green tea, and it's got some honey and some lemon, and I'm enjoying that. And we are actually here tonight, kind of by your request, right? Because I know we talked about this in the past, but you know, you had mentioned, and I don't even remember if you mentioned like Gatchaman by name or if you mentioned Battle of the Planets by name, but I think we were just chatting about that kind of, you know, nonchalantly and everything. And then, you know, me being the lazy podcaster that I am, I was like, well, there's no way I'm going to watch 105 episodes of Gatchaman for one single podcast. So I was like, you know, there's this compilation movie. It came out in 1978, you know, Gatchaman the movie. And essentially, like, you know, I'll try to do the quick and dirty Justin version of this. But basically, you know, the Wikipedia synopsis basically tells us that this movie is a feature length retelling of the events of the TV series. But it's a compilation movie. It's like, you know, it's like when I'm always referring to the Mobile Suit Gundam movies. You know, they had those three movies where, you know, they compiled like the key essential episodes, and then those movies almost became, you know, Gundam canon instead of the 39 episodes, right? Kind of, you know, cutting away some of the filler and maybe adding some brand new animation and stuff like that. And this, for the most part, is just consistent with that, but it has basically the footage from what Wikipedia is calling the quote-unquote key episodes, which is basically the first two episodes, episodes 51 to 53, which is that whole V2 project arc, and then the final four episodes where they, you know, have the final fatal battle with Berg Katza and Galactor and the bad guys and all that stuff. And one thing I thought was interesting, which I do kind of enjoy in this version, they say instead of the music from the TV show by Bob Sakuma, an all-new score was composed by Koichi Sugiyama and performed by the NHK Symphony Orchestra. It was notably the first Japanese animated movie to feature a stereo soundtrack. So that's kind of cool. I don't know. Maybe I'll kick this off by tossing it over to you. But I was thinking about this before we got together, and it's hard for me to remember because I know a lot of kids grew up with Battle of the Planets, and like I think this is right in that time frame, like, you know, when I was born, or, you know, at least in that range of the late 70s when they were doing Battle of the Planets. And I know it had, you know, there's some kind of obvious go-tos. Like I was familiar with it in terms of I knew of its existence, but I feel like my earliest memories of it are like when it, and I don't even know if I'm remembering this right, but I think maybe like either like Toonami or something, you know, like they would re-air it like in this kind of retro vein when I was in my 20s or so. And I remember my buddy was showing me, you know, the Battle of the Planets episodes and everything. And we were kind of laughing about Seven Zark Seven or whatever, you know, and you know, he's a little, you know, C-3PO R2-D2 ripoff that they insert into the, you know, the anime and everything, because it was that whole, what, Hanna-Barbera kind of produced stuff, and they had their own animation that they inserted into certain episodes when they kind of localized it for here. And I remember, you know, of course, Alex Ross would do all these, you know, painted images of, you know, Gatchaman or Battle of the Planets or whatever. And there, you know, there were those revivals where, you know, they released it on DVD. Like, I think there were like Rhino DVD sets for Battle of the Planets. And then I think what I have now is this like really souped up, really beautiful, you know, I think it's either Sentai or Discotech, I forget what company it is, but these really, really nice Blu-ray sets where, you know, it's like all 105 episodes, like a bunch of the OVAs and stuff like that. And then there's this separate Blu-ray that's just this compilation movie, which I think I bought on sale for like $8.99 or something like that on one of these Christmas sales. So I thought, you know, we'd talk, you know, with the framework of this movie, but give you an opportunity to kind of share like how you discovered this, how you got into it, like what your take is and how you're involved in, you know, whatever fandom there is that exists for this franchise and everything.
Watching over them from Center Neptune, their computerized coordinator, Seven Zark Seven. Watching, warning against surprise attacks by alien galaxies beyond space. Young orphans protecting Earth's entire galaxy, always five, acting as one, dedicated, inseparable, invincible.
And I guess all I was going to lead off into was like, I feel like these 70s anime, like even if I didn't like grow up on them, or even maybe some stuff from the 80s, like I always felt like maybe I got home too late to watch them, and I would always catch the tail end of, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I always felt like I knew what Voltron was. I knew what Robotech was. And I knew that there were toys that were marketed to me as a kid. And I think Battle of the Planets is almost akin to like the Marvin and Wendy episodes of Super Friends, where I was like, damn, I wasn't even born yet. I don't think they fully registered for me until I was, quote unquote, an adult, or at least in my 20s, or, you know, so basically when they started, you know, targeting those, you know, people of our vintage, right, on Cartoon Network or Toonami or what, you know, when, wherever those things were airing, and then they sort of re-aired them, and then you were kind of like, oh yeah, I have vague like memories of that. And it was also kind of like that whole Forbidden Fruit thing where you're like, oh, I didn't get home enough in time, you know, soon enough in time to watch this, or I don't know, whatever the deal was. So like I guess I've always had an affinity for 70s era anime, whether or not it was something that was nostalgic for me or not. I feel like just the vintage of it and the era of it is nostalgic by default, whether I'd been exposed to it or not. I'm kind of curious, because I know you were jonesing about, you know, talking about this with me and coming on the show, you know, specifically to kind of talk about either, you know, Battle of the Planets or Gatchaman. So I assume that the first time you ever saw this, it was as the localized version as Battle of the Planets, right?
Yes. Yeah. And to go to take it back even a little bit farther here, the whole reason for this is because, you know, I'm a fan of the history of comics on film, you know, that's done by yourself. And you, I think you had released something like about was it Super J, I think was the show.
Battle Fever J.
And I had seen that, and I was like, dude, have you ever thought about talking about Gatchaman? Because I don't know timeline wise, and you and probably Justin would have a much better idea timeline wise as far as like when the Super Sentai stuff first came out and all that, but I was like, you know, with Gatchaman initially releasing in 1972,
yeah,
I think it would probably be a forebear or an influence, you know,
definitely.
To Sentai would become, you know, the team of five acting as one type of a thing.
Yeah, very much, you know, very much so.
But as far as like my first exposure to Gatchaman, or what I only knew until, you know, the internet and the mid to late 90s as Battle of the Planets, God, I want to say it was somewhere between the age of 3 and 4. So it was right in that sweet spot cusp time, like 1980-ish, 79-80, when, you know, my first comic books I first got, and seeing Super Friends on Saturdays for the first time, and, you know, Johnny Quest on weekday afternoon. So I was just, my senses were starting to get barraged by all of this, you know, fantastic artwork and Hoyt Curtin music, and, you know, the visual images of guys like Sal Buscema and Jack Kirby-ish type stuff and George Pratt. So it was like just across the board, it was just like this was a grand time where everything was just hitting. And Battle of the Planets would come on, and it kind of funny how this works. So as a kid, my mom had to work, you know, early in the morning. You know, I had to be to work like 7 or some god-awful hour like that. And so she'd wake my sorry ass up at about 5 a.m., you know, to get me ready, get my bowl of cereal, get my stuff going while she's getting ready for her work. So I would tool around on the TV, and we had a station for the folks out there. You know, I'm located in Montana, so it's kind of a regionally specific thing here, but we would get the TV station CFAC coming out of Lethbridge in Calgary. And that was where we got all of our cartoon fixes, like later on G.I. Joe, Transformers, and everything there. So at 5:30 in the morning, all of a sudden, I'm getting blasted by this great Hoyt Curtin written introduction. You see the God Phoenix. Now, of course, in America, we weren't going to call that the God Phoenix. Heaven forbid we use the word God in anything. So it's got to be the Phoenix.
Well, and there's the argument the Japanese use God a little too liberally as well. It's like everything is fucking God this and God that. So, yeah.
right? and you see the Phoenix coming across the Earth and then shooting up in the sky. And then all of a sudden, battle of the planets. And, you know, it introduced, you know, the five teenagers, G-Force. You know, because heaven, you know, because again, us as Americans, we're not going to understand Science Ninja Team, Gotcha Man. It was G-Force. And, you know, we introduce the five and then we get Seven's Arc 7. And I don't know how much you're aware of the history on that, but basically Seven's Arc 7 came about, A, because of, you know, the love of, you know, let's rip off R2-D2 and Star Wars. But what it boils down to is the censorship of cartoons that was going on in the 70s and 80s. Whereas, you know, like if you watch an episode of Super Friends, Superman never punched a villain, but he was punching rocks and
mountains. Right.
Nobody ever. And if you watch some of those uncut episodes of Gotcha Man, yeah, there was no way those were clearing U.S. censors in any way. So all of this, you know, when they had to cut stuff out, they would lose anywhere between 2 to 10 minutes worth of episode footage. So they had to fill that time somehow. And then that's when all of a sudden we got the Sandy Frank produced newer stuff with Seven's Arc 7 and his sexy robot companion Susan, and, you know, all the members of G-Force playing table tennis in the rec room and shit. They had to fill that time somehow. So that's how we ended up getting that. But yeah, no, I was obsessed with Battle of the Planets. That was my favorite cartoon, end all be all, hands down, you know, for growing up. I mean, just between the ages of like 4 and 7. I mean, that was 5:30. My ass was up and I was watching Battle of the Planets regardless if I had to go to the babysitter or not. It did not matter. And then, you know, eventually it went away. There were heavy nostalgia goggles when it came to Battle of the Planets, just the memory of it. And, you know, Casey Kasem as the team leader. That's a horrible impression of Casey, and I'm so sorry that I just did that. But, you know, he was the team leader, Mark. He had Lonnie Shell that was doing the voice of Jason. I mean, just across the board, you know. And so, like I said, there was these great nostalgia goggles. And then, God, I want to say sometime around like 97, 98, back in the days when we still had like dial-up internet connections, I found a website and I started looking at stuff, and then come to find out, okay, Battle of the Planets. I always knew there was something odd, you know, different about it. When that was when I found out, oh, it was anime. Oh, it was way darker in tone than what we got in America. Mm. And so I would download. For a lot of you kids out there, when we're talking almost, you know, 30 years ago, we didn't have things like YouTube. So to download a 10-second snippet of something, it took forever. Start downloading and then go about your day. And then maybe when you come back sometime that evening, you may have it downloaded for your whole 10-second clip of greatness.
I always fondly reminisce about that, even though it was like torturous, because the thing I always point to is the Canada would get the new episodes of Beast Machines, you know, the Transformers show, like before the U.S. would, just because I guess it was released, you know, Mainframe was a Canadian company or whatever the deal was, and they would get those first. And I remember I was like, oh boy, and people would upload them online, and I had dial up in my LA apartment that was free because I was basically mooching off of like my dad's AOL dial up or whatever it was while I was out there. And man, it was like one of these things where I'd be like, I mean, you're not kidding, like go on about your day. Like I would start it like and then go to sleep and then wake up and it would still be like just about finished. You know what I mean? Like it would take like 24 hours before you could get like a 20-minute fucking cartoon or whatever it was. So yeah, TJ's not kidding. I don't know that there's anybody who's listening to this that needs the explanation, but you know, I mean, it's just one of those things, you know.
It was like cavemen beating rocks back in those days for internet at that point in time. So it was then at that point when I was like, oh my God, there was. And so then I started kind of getting like re-obsessed with Battle of the Planets again, I think. And at that point, it was because of the fact that, you know, again, we didn't have what we didn't have access to things like we do now. I've been going back and listening to some old fan hole episodes, you know, kind of playing catch up and stuff. And I think you, at one point, it brought up a really great fact of that our generation versus the younger generation. The younger generation is never really going to understand the beauty of nostalgia. Mm. You know, they have instant access to everything. Almost everything is at their fingertips. Whereas us, You know, unless we can find, you know, back in those days, unless we could find some kind of, you know, half-assed bootleg thing that may or may not work that we buy from some shady dealer at a convention, odds are we weren't going to be able to get it, you know, that old stuff. And, you know, maybe tape traders and that type of deal. But anyways, sorry, I'm digressing on that.
No.
Then it became more of the mystery of Gotcha Man. And I want to see these, you know, episodes in their entirety and you know, really how dark and, you know, how much more shit was going on with these episodes. And then when I was living in Jersey, when I was doing that, you know, doing the pro wrestling thing, that was when Rhino did the re-release of Planets on DVD. And so I got those as they were coming out. I think they were coming out like every 6 weeks or something like that. I can't remember what the time frame was. But I got the first 6 volumes that they released as they were coming out. And then that was my first exposure to full Gotcha Man episodes, because they had the Battle of the Planets episodes. And then they had the subtitled complete original Gotcha Man episodes. So then I got to see, oh, yeah, there's like a huge, you know, way big difference without Seven's Arc 7 muddying up the waters and kind of going into the movie here. You know, the first, when they use the first 2 episodes, I mean, combined, I think they only use like 5 minutes or 10 minutes out
right,
of 2.
Right.
So you miss like a lot of great stuff, like the introductory scene where they're merging the vehicles and introducing each member of Gotcha Man. That's like just done like really quick in the opening credits. I don't speak or read Japanese, so I don't know what was being said on, you know, what was written on there. But again, you miss, and this is going to kind of be an over-encompassing theme on this Kagaku Ninja Tai Gotcha Man, the movie. There's a lot of nuances and a lot of, you know, a lot of carryover story arcs and a lot of things that are far easier explained watching the entire series.
Right. I mean, that's how these clip shows work, basically. I mean, they are compilation movies or whatever. You know, it's like there's a lot of subtle stuff that you end up missing out on. But I guess, again, this is that you can lay at my feet, because I'm just like lazy. I didn't want to, you know, watch 105 episodes or whatever. You know, I just kind of wanted to get a flavor of it. And I was like, this will be good enough. But I appreciate what you're saying, because when you're really into like whatever fandom it is, whether it's, you know, Mobile Suit Gundam or, you know, anything, it's like usually there's, you know, when they do these kind of compilation movies, it's like, yeah, you zip through the introductions and then try to get to the meaty parts of the show like almost instantly. And then, like you're saying, that you miss out on some things. You know, I think for me, I was kind of like, I kept watching this, you know, I think I watched the dub and then I watched it subtitled. And then I think I looked at, you know, some of the actual episodes here or there, because I was like, oh, I think for me, like, I kind of missed the whole thing where when the fuck did Joe Condor throw the fucking feather? You know, like, I was like trying to figure that out. And then I don't think I noticed it until I watched like the individual episode. And I was just like, oh, I'll be damned, he did throw the damn feather. I see what you're saying, when you can miss like subtle things or, you know, important things that, you know, you get more out of it if you just watch the entire series.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if we want to go chronologically through the movie on this, but, you know, one of the big things when you get towards that last third, when they were kind of using the last 4 episodes to tell the, I guess, if you want to call it the third act, you know, they just kind of gloss over and say, oh, yeah, Joe's got a brain injury, he's only going to last a week. And for the uninitiated or someone who's just piping in, it's like, wait a second, when the hell did Joe get a brain injury? What this is kind of like some kind of crazy ass, whatever the opposite of Deus Ex Machina is, you know, where the hell did this happen? And not understanding that, you know, 80 episodes prior, I think it was like episode 20, where, you know, there was like some Galactor giant mech that was destroying shit or whatever. There was earthquakes or some god awful thing, I don't remember. And Joe was saving a puppy. And as he was saving the puppy, there was this explosion and he got shrapnel stuck in his head. And so throughout the series, you would see where he would have moments of not concussion type shit, but, you know, light sensitivity, or, you know, just like be in the middle of something and just like go into a seizure or something like that. So, I mean, it was a major ongoing story arc throughout that first series. And in this movie, it just kind of like barely touches on it. And it's like, oh yeah, he's got a brain injury, so things are getting screwed up. So then a little bit later on, when he's fighting all the Galactor dudes, and then Bird Kotze shines a spotlight on him. He's like, why in the hell does he freeze up because of a spotlight? I thought he was supposed to be a badass, not understanding that because of this shrapnel-induced brain injury that he's got going on, bright lights are like with me, the ultimate weakness, you know? So yeah. it's like that. Or, you know, another thing, and again, I don't know about, you know, spotting, jumping out of turn and type stuff, but, and we can go into this a little bit later on, when Joe makes the comment of your tridentities haven't been revealed. He says that to Bird Kotze. Says, oh, you know.
Yeah. They don't go into all that. Yeah. Not enough. There's not enough time to go into that in the compilation movie.
But that's one of like the crazy, what, you know, what the shit storylines that goes on within the series that people don't know or understand about what makes Bird Kotze such a damaged, you know, a great damaged character with these tridentities that's just glossed over and just never discussed.
I mean, again, that's something, right, where I think, you know, the Battle of the Planets localization, we're like, nope, we're not touching that. Like, you know, and I think if I recall correctly, like they just treated it like a totally separate character that was like his evil sister or something like that. Like, and, yeah. You know, it kind of reminds me of, I think anyone who, there might be, you know, discrepancies, but I mean, to me, it reminds me of like seeing Voltron and then seeing Golion, you know what I mean? Like the whole idea of like, oh, you know, Sven didn't die. He went off to another planet to hang out with, you know, Poochie or whatever. And then he comes, you know what I mean? Like whereas I think in the Golion thing, it's like, oh, Sven dies. And it's his, you know, twin brother that comes back in the later episode or whatever it was. Right. Like, you know, you've got these things that were considered too hot to handle for, I guess, U.S. kid audiences, you know, things that they tried to tone down or clean up or, you know, however you want to phrase it, you know, or just sidestep. Right. Like, but, you know, I was just looking at it like for a frame of reference and because I did want to talk about this. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's, you know, a prototype, you know, for what would become Super Sentai, right? Because you've got, like you said, Gatchaman from, what, 1972 to 1974 is when these 105 episodes aired. And the initial, I mean, it wasn't even really Super Sentai at this point, but Go Ranger is the very first unofficial Super Sentai. It was just Sentai, right? Like there was no giant robot, right? Like it was just the five comrades, you know, doing the quote unquote Power Ranger thing, right? With a sixth, you know, additional, you know, ranger that shows up somewhere throughout the course of the, you know, 50 or 70 or however many episodes it was. And that comes out the year after. That comes out in 1975. And you don't have the Super Sentai aspect until Battle Fever J, which is 1979. So like, and I think all of those things, like, I think they said, like, the guy who directed or came up with Gatchaman, you know, they would ask him about what some of his influences were or whatever. And they talk about how, like, American superheroes were influential on Gatchaman. And I feel like that's, like, evident in weird little funny ways, like, where if you look at the comics of the 70s and you look at, like, the happenstance of Casey Kasem voicing, you know, Mark or Ken or, you know, whatever we're calling him, you know, and like, you know, it's like, well, Casey Kasem was Robin too. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, and you make these parallels, like, you're like, oh, wait, Colonel Cronus or, you know, whatever his name is, the Japanese version. He's like, here, let me look up because I don't remember these things. But, let's see. His name is Red Impulse, right? But Colonel Cronus. And then it turns out like, oh, that's Ken Mark's father or whatever, right? And it's like, to me, it's like, it feels like Batman and Robin, or like if Robin didn't know that Batman was really his father, or, you know, like that whole kind of thing. Like, and you know, him leading this team of guys, it's like, well, if Robin's not leading the Teen Titans, they all go to shit, you know. And then when Mark's not around, you know, or Ken's not around, you know, it's like the G-Force or whatever, they all go to shit. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like there's things like that that I feel are very similar. And then like just goofy shit, like where, you know, it reminds me of like old Bob Haney, Brave and the Bold, where like, you know, it's like Batman will be in like a disguise with a sombrero 1 minute, and then he'll take off the disguise and all of a sudden he's in like full on bat ears regalia and all that shit. And it's like some of that stuff is similar, because it's like they talk about how when this was localized, Battle of the Planets, like the title in and of itself, and the way they tried to frame all these episodes, it was like this space opera. It was like trying to capitalize on Star Wars and whatever was popular at the time. And that was probably like, for somebody like me who loves science fiction and all that stuff, you know, we probably as kids, we ate that stuff up. But if you look at some of this stuff, it's like there's stuff in here that's like way more super heroic. But then there's also stuff that's like, it transitions to like super spy stuff, especially all that stuff with Red Impulse, where they're like, they're in those diver suits and they're sneaking around. And it's like, it's almost like, well, this isn't space opera. This is like James Bond espionage stuff, you know? And it's like somebody like Batman, you know, in the 70s could easily transition between like adventure, super spy, James Bond stuff to like wacky outer space, you know, like they could go back and forth and do all those things. And then the other thing that I kind of wanted to bring up, because you mentioned it, and this is what I think you hit the nail on the head, was like you said, oh, you know, it's very influential on Sentai and Super Sentai. And what really struck me watching this, and it's not 100%, but like I feel like there's the flavors of it and everything. And like what I've always said was there's a specific Super Sentai series that's called Jetman. And Jetman is a series, let me see, I'm just going to look it up. It ran from 1991 to 1992. So it's kind of in that era of, you know, like what I was trying to explain to you the other night about like Heisei Godzilla, you know, it's in that Heisei period or whatever. So it's not something that like was early on in the 70s or whatever. It's widely regarded as like one of the most soap operatic like Sentai series there is. And it's like, It reminds me very much like where they have like Jetman Red is very much like the Cyclops, the Jetman Black is very much like the Wolverine, and then the you know, one of the girls in it is very much like the Jean Grey that they're both like fighting over and all, you know, and there's all this drama and shit, and kind of like I don't know, I just got the vibe where it was like a lot like Ken, Joe, and June, like to use the Japanese names and just make it easy on myself because I'm looking at all of them. But you know, Ken's like the Robin Cyclops, you know, Joe's the badass going off on his own, beating up all these guys, but getting his ass whooped. I mean, it reminds me of Wolverine in the sewers beating up the Hellfire Club when he's like taking out all those bad guys in the spaceship and, you know, then eventually, you know, getting his ass whooped and eventually, you know, him kind of, you know, like, in some ways sacrificing himself, but also being the guy who helped save the day all at the same time, you know? So it's like, I don't know, like all those things just seem like, I think you're absolutely right. Like all this stuff had a, you know, I don't know who saw it when or, you know, how that all flows, but you can certainly see the influence or impact, or you can trace it back and kind of go, oh, damn, like this is very, I mean, I don't know, to me, like maybe not so much the localization and Battle of the Planets, but at least this Gatchaman show is very soap operatic. I feel like, you know, like the, you know, the stuff with Joe where he's like, oh, I'm dying, and he's going to, you know, have his last hurrah and go out, you know, and save the day and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and all the characters that are, you know, running around in this. So I don't know, like that was kind of my takeaway watching this, where I feel like, you know, I don't know if any of the Japanese guys were reading like, you know, Cockrum and Byrne, Claremont X-Men at the time. But I mean, I feel like some of that seeped into this and then seeped into Jetman and, and all these other shows, you know.
And I mean, probably, you know, they're because I think at that time, really, probably the Claremont X-Men was really, and you know, Claremont and Byrne X-Men was probably really the only thing that was being that soap operatic, for lack of a better term. You know, because I mean, I remember comic books in the, you know, the late 60s, early 70s was pretty much one and done type stuff. There wasn't, you know, Marvel had a lot more pathos, but there wasn't a whole lot of, like, you know, ongoing subplotty type stuff. I mean, yeah, there might have been here and there, but I think Claremont's X-Men was really the only one that was really kind of doing that at that time. So I'm pretty sure that had to have been a big influence for those, you know, for the Gotchman episodes. It's kind of like when if you're going through the first, I don't know, 15 or so of them, I think that was kind of when they were finding their way and making sure they were going to get, you know, a full second season or whatever it might be. Cause it was a lot of freak of the week type stuff. You know, who's our mecca of the week that we've got to face? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until probably somewhere around, I mean, they would start planting seeds like the first episode with Red Impulse was like, I don't know, episode like 5 or 6 or somewhere around in there.
Right.
And who is this Red Impulse? Who do they think they are? And, you know, that type of thing. So there was like this little rivalry going on between the Science Ninja Team and Red Impulse. And
if you've seen enough Japanese anime, even as a casual watcher of this, you probably figure it out pretty quickly, right? Like, I mean, this, I think, was created by the same guy that created Mach Go-Go 5 or what, you know. So it's like, oh, that was localized to Speed Racers, what, Big Brother is Racer X, right? Like it's the same trope, right? It's like some masked guy who's always helping out the lead young guy, you know, and then it turns out they have this familial connection and you're like, of course, duh, it's so obvious, you know. Like, but I think if you've seen that trope once and then it kind of shows up again, it's like super obvious. But if you've never, you know, I guess if you're totally new to that kind of trope or anime or whatever, you know, whatever the first time you encounter that, you know, whether it's, I don't know, something like, you know, Cable, you know, being like, oh, my father is Cyclops, like, ta-da, what a shock, or, you know, like whoever it is, right? Whenever you first encounter that, that can be, you know, potentially mind blowing. But I think at this point, you know, being semi jaded or whatever, you know, it's kind of like you see Red Impulse and then they keep talking about, oh, you know, Ken's looking for his father. And I'm just kind of like, oh, that dude's his dad for sure. And sure enough, you know, like towards the, you know, the climax of the thing, they're like, oh, by the way, whoever that is, the guy with the mustache that sends them on all their missions, you know, he's like, I forgot to tell you guys, that's Ken's dad. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's Ken's dad. And I was like, I knew that, like, you know, a half an hour ago or whatever, you know.
Well, and see, you know, and again, you know, this goes back to that, I don't know if the deus ex machina is the right phrasing to use on it, but if you're going into this blind, if you've never known anything about Gotchaman, Battle of the Planets, or what was it, G-Force, Guardians of Space was like the later localization they did like somewhere in like the late 80s, early 90s, that was even worse. I wasn't a fan of that one. But if you're going in totally blind, you have no idea. You're like, wait a second, what? Red Impulse is dead. Why is this important? I don't get it. Once again, if you're watching those episodes leading up to it, and you have the first episode, you know, there's an episode where Ken meets this kid who loses his father, and he relates to about how he lost his father, and then a couple episodes later we meet Red Impulse, and it builds up. And hints are dropped, but you're never quite 100% sure what it is. You have a sneaking suspicion, and they keep building and building and building until you're like, no, that's got to be his dad. You know, it's the buildup and the anticipation for that grand moment when you finally get that revelation, and Ken gets the revelation, and this is going to be great, and they're going to go out. And then it's kind of bittersweet in the fact that, yeah, Ken finds out about, you know, he gets the revelation that Red Impulse is his father. And within less than a minute, his father's going off into a rocket and dying. So they never really get to have that, you know, father-son connection in any way, shape, or form other than in combat. And again, it loses that punch doing this with this movie, because you miss out on, And again, I don't know if they showed these like, you know, once a week. I don't know if they, you know, I don't know how they were originally aired in Japan.
Usually it was weekly. Like the only thing that confuses me now, like lately, is if you go back far enough for things like Go Ranger and Gatchaman, like the episode number counts seem insanely high, like where you're like 105 episodes, you know what I mean? Like where you're like, wow, that's a lot, right? But if you think about it, it's like, okay, like in certain cases, what they usually point to is they'll say like, oh, well, it follows the structure of a year. There's 52 weeks in a year. So like in some ways, like a lot of anime, you know, it'll run for, you know, 50 odd episodes, right? And you're like, oh, well, that makes sense, right? Because there's 52 weeks in a year. But sometimes when you look at some of the older episode number counts and you're like, oh, well, that's, but I guess if that's over 3 years, and you split the difference, right? You're like, oh, what is that? Like 30 something episodes a year, you know? So it's like, okay, well, maybe it wasn't every single week, right? Which, you know, to American viewers would be insane anyway, because we always had, you know, the downtime of the holidays or the summer where we had reruns and all that other stuff, right? Whereas I think in some cases, some airings of Japanese shows, there wasn't anything like that taken into account. It was just, you know, straight 13 weeks in a row or straight 26 weeks in a row or straight 52 weeks in a row, and you get like a whole season of whatever, you know, anime it is, right? You know, so I'm guessing for this, I mean, it must have been, you know, on a weekly basis.
Yeah. And I it's a case of like, you know, here again, 72 through 74, how much, you know, if it was through 3 years, I mean, they definitely had to have taken like a summer hiatus so they could catch up on the art, because I mean, you know, for the production of it, because good Lord, if you're trying to sit there and do 52 episodes of how much lead time do you have to be able to make sure you're getting an episode a week out for an entire year? That's insane.
Well, so, and that's also to the advantage of anime, right? Like it's not like American style animation. It's a lot of still captured frames. It's a lot of reuse. It's, you know, like there's things like that where it's almost a combination of the Filmation style, where, you know, Filmation did have a lot of reuse, right? But then the other thing that, you know, I think the thing that Americans would commonly point their fingers and poke fun at is, you know, the idea that basically the only, you know, and it's funny because it is pretty evident in watching it on like a high def Blu-ray, but like there's some of those moments where you see the team talking to one another, and you know, it's the common refrain, right? It's like the only thing that's actually being animated is the lip flap, you know what I mean? And it's like, but in that sense, like that saves, I mean, that was the whole point of anime. Like it's less frames per second in the animation, and in certain cases the only thing being animated is like the primary point of focus. So it's like you don't animate the entire old man on the phone, you just animate when he talks, and then maybe it's just the lip flap and one movement, right? Like and that was another cost-cutting method to the whole, you know, madness that is anime. But you're right, though. I mean, it, you know, 105 episodes over 3 years is pretty intense period.
So I mean, regardless, yeah, I mean, the production time on it would just, like I said, one way or the other, I mean, it's insane to think about that. You know, going back at the overall, the big umbrella picture on this is you miss out on a lot of the drama and that soap opera type feel with a bunch of the different stuff that goes on. There really wasn't that love triangle, at least I never noticed, I never saw. There really wasn't the love triangle between Ken, Joe, and June. It was more along the lines of when are Ken and June going to admit their feelings for each other?
Right, right.
And the other three, Joe, Ryu, and Jinpei, you know, they're all just hurry up and bang or something. We just, you know, we'll give you 10 minutes alone in the Phoenix, whatever. Just we hurry up already. You know, there was that ongoing drama. There was a continual back and forth thing between Ken being the staunch leader, we must always do right, and then Joe, who is like that rebel, that rogue, that wild stallion that no one could ever tame. I mean, good Lord, those first 20 plus so episodes going all the way through, they were constantly bickering me all day.
Right.
Every
right.
I want to use the bird missiles. I want to use the bird missiles. And we can't. I mean, that was, you know, just a prime example of that. And then they finally have like their one episode where they duke it out and have a street fight in the middle of a back alley. When we get that, quote, you know, that quasi Joe death scene in that third act, it doesn't quite hold as much of a punch with this compilation movie as it does if you've gone through 105 episodes of the ups and the downs and understanding that these guys are brothers and, you know, brothers bicker, family bickers, but they still love each other. Mm. You don't get that in 2 hours as you do in 51 hours.
And I think, I think at least me not having seen all 105 episodes, like, I mean, I own the damn thing, but I don't think I've gone through all 105 episodes, right? All I'll say is, and this is not a defense, like, it's just, it's the way these compilation movies are, right? They try to assemble a greatest hits, and they try, right? Like, I mean, you're never going to get all the nuance you get in 105 episodes, but I think I picked up most of what they were trying to put down, you know, like you got the vibe of it. It did strike me, you know, that Joe was like the black, you know, Jetman Black or Wolverine of the team, that guy, you know, maybe even back in the day of the Avengers, you know, he was the Hawkeye to Captain America, you know, constantly questioning, constantly in the guy's face, always kind of, you know, challenging him or whatever. But then, you know, as the comic or the anime or, you know, whatever it is progresses, you know, there's this begrudging respect between them. And, you know, I mean, they don't all end with, you know, the guy dying or whatever, but in this one it does. And also with the Jetman thing, I mean, spoilers, I mean, it's that trajectory is very similar, you know, and it just hit me like a bag of bricks.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, I think it was just more of the pacing. Like, I'm not,
I'm not arguing with you because I think you're hitting on all the points, like as a review, as a critique. Like I think it's the same sad critique for every compilation movie. And it's compounded by the fact that Japanese pacing is vastly different from Western pacing as well, you know. So it's like you're gonna have like a double whammy. It's like they're doing a compilation, quote unquote, movie version of something. It's like, it's kind of like when you would go and see you know, the Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man episodes, and they compiled like two episodes together as a quote unquote movie, right? And it's like, is it really paced and structured like a movie? Like, not really. Do you know what I mean? Like, do you get the same vibe you'd get if you watched all, like, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, you know, 15 to 20 episodes of the Nicholas Hammond series? Like, hell no. But do you at least get the gist of it? Like, probably. You know, it was good enough to slap a poster up and get some foreign money or whatever, however they work those films. And I think that's kind of what this was for. It was like, oh, I think you're right. You probably have to be an existing fan, you know, and just, you know, go into it going kind of like, okay, this is not going to give me the full picture. But if this is somebody's first exposure to it and it kind of whets their appetite, then yeah, then they should go back and watch, you know, all of them. Or maybe even if you're having any kind of doubt, probably best, if you want to invest the time, watch the 105 episodes and then come back to this and be like TJ and be like, hey, you know, this missed this nuance and that nuance and doesn't have the same impact because of the way it's structured and how quick it is, you know, like.
Right. You know, and again, I realize that it may come off like I'm just sitting here just bitching about this thing and just poking holes through it and all that. But I also, you know, understand the fact that, you know, they did this in 78 as a theatrical release. It very well could have been, and I would have to dig a little deeper to see when release dates for Gatchaman 2 was. And Gatchaman Fighter, or Gatchaman F, as it's also known, basically the Gatchaman trilogy. Part of me is wondering did that movie come out at the time when Gatchaman Fighter was coming out? You know, it was
it looks like it came out around the same time that Gatchaman 2 came out. So maybe also it was like a promotional vehicle. It was kind of like, it's kind of like you don't need to catch up on all 105 episodes because we don't even have them available. We're not even showing them on TV at the moment. But if you go watch this movie, then come back and watch Gatchaman 2 on TV, right? And
a little bit to set up for Gatchaman 2 is kind of, yeah, it's kind of that may have been used for
that. I mean, that seems, given the time frame, that seems incredibly likely.
The other knock that I'm going to have on this, and I know you had made the comment about how they took they basically replaced Bob Sakura's music with what was his name, Koichi Sugiyama.
Koichi Sugiyama. Yeah.
Okay. And while the music sounded nice in that John Williams-esque sort of way, I gotta admit, for my own fanboy sensibilities, I really missed hearing Bob Sakura's music.
Okay.
Through this, just because it gives the right vibe for the overall picture of the series and of the episodes and the feel and the vibe. It's kind of like how you want all of your pieces to kind of complete the puzzle, and whether it's the music, the sound effects, the voices, whatever it may be, Sakura's music was a very important piece of that puzzle. And I kind of felt that not having that music in there, like as I was sitting there listening, they kept kind of replaying that theme that they were doing in the, with the opening credits. They would replay that constantly, and it's like, it's getting a little annoying. And it wasn't until the act where they finally did kind of like a reprisal of the original Gatchaman theme song in this Sugiyama's NHK symphonic, in that style. And I think the movie would have been better served had, like I said, I mean, if he put in his own touches and used the symphony, but still stuck with Sakura's original music, original beats, that type of thing, I think I probably would have been a little less critical about the music on it. That one really was kind of the big sore thumb that stuck out to me, was I really missed Bob Sakura's music in this compilation movie.
So what I'm generally getting out of this is TJ wants you all to watch 105 episodes of Gatchaman at bare minimum, and that he has a strong sense of love and nostalgia for Battle of the Planets. Does that extend like elsewhere? Like, did you find yourself like, I know, what is it, Tsukinoko, that's the company that owns or made the series. Like, I remember when they had like, I don't know if it was like Smash Brothers, or they had their version of it, like Tsukinoko Fighter. And it was like they had their own fighting game. And I know for sure, like Ken was one of the playable characters. Like, I'm trying to think of like other periphery stuff. Like, I remember, I think Diamond Select came out with like Gatchaman figures. And there, I remember at one point there was some really high end Gatchaman figures from Japan that came out. I think it was the same company that made all those like really expensive Iron Man figures, but I can't remember what the company was called. But anyway, there were like lots of stuff like that where, it's like, I just think the visual of Ken is really cool. So it's like anytime I would see stuff like that, I always wonder about that, because I'm like, you have to be really dedicated to get all five of those guys if you're like paying money for it. But I'm sure Ken always sells. But then I'm like, oh, but do people go like all out and get like all five of them? Like, it makes me wonder,
Well, I mean, what kind of pisses me off is the fact that, and I haven't really gone into, other mediums for my Gatchaman Battle of the Planets fix. It's like they basically just put out, figure-wise, they just put out Ken, Joe, and June, and then they just leave Genpei and Ryu in the dust. They just say, yeah, we're not
you guys. Well, much like this compilation movie. I mean, they Ken clearly gets time because he's the leader. June gets some play. It's not like she's spotlighted, but she's certainly at least integral enough, right? And then Joe obviously is heavily featured in this compilation movie. But like you're saying, Jinpei and Ryu, like, you know, they might have a moment or two, you know, it's like, oh, look, Ryu's talking to the girl and now there's an emergency. You know what I mean? It's like, that's basically the extent of it, right?
Yeah. It's like, oh, we don't need the comic relief kids. But at the end of the day, you still want to have all five of these, you know, you still, if you're a completionist, if you're somebody that's appreciative of the series and the brand, you still want to have all five of the guys. I mean, how else are you going to have your whirlwind fighter technique pyramid to be able, if you don't have two of your damn guys on there? I mean, my God. Which, of course, we never got to see that in this compilation movie, I might add. The one thing that kind of disappointed me with those, like when with the Rhino collection, the only way you were going to complete that set, they had released, I want to say they were like 12 inch, maybe Mego sized figures at the time. And you had, again, you only had the three, Ken, June, and Joe. And I want to say each of those had a different volume, like 7, 8, and 9. So unless you went and got those figures, you wouldn't be able to get those DVDs. They were the only places, they were the only things that had those. And so when my local, when Hastings started closing down, I don't know if you had a Hastings out in your area. They were mostly kind of west of the Mississippi, like Montana, Texas, Oregon. I think they had a couple, but I think they were predominantly in Northern California, like up in the Redding area or something like that. So I'm not sure if you're too familiar with them. But when they shut their doors down, I was going through looking for different, you know, stuff, because it was basically the closest thing to a nerd store that we had. And I saw that they had like the 25th anniversary compilation of Battle of the Planets. And I was like, okay, cool, I'll get that. And so this compilation disc was like Rhino's final Battle of the Planets release. And it jumps ahead. So you've got the episodes that came with those Mego figures of like, say, volume 7, 8, 9. And then let's just say this was like volumes 10 through 12 in this deal. So there's this gap. And the only way you could fill that gap is if you went out and got those figures. And I have no idea what their, you know, what kind of back,
aftermarket.
Aftermarket price hike scalping is going on with those guys. I'm not a big Funko Pop collector. I think I've got like five of them. And it's basically just like, here are the most key important figures in my nerd world. These will identify. Anyone could look at the top of my shelf, see those five Funko figures, and they'll understand me perfectly to a T. Of course, I've got Ken the Eagle, you know, but again, love those Funko figures. All they have is Ken, June, and Joe. You can kind of see it going on there.
Yep. Did you, my memory of this is pretty poor in terms of how much I liked it, but did you ever see the Japanese live action film?
I watched the trailers. I tried watching it, and I just, it didn't click with me.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think it was very good or even very well received. I feel like probably like there's somebody probably could pull it off really well, but they have not to this point. And, you know, unfortunately, they tried the one time and it was pretty abysmal. So it's funny because, you know, every once in a while I see things and I highly recommend them. Like they, you know, they nail whatever it is that they're adapting into live action, you know, but in this case, I guess to date, they have not.
Yeah, it didn't hit the mark for me there. Oh, no. Oh, and also, you know, going back to the other medias type thing. I know you're talking like Smash Brothers. The only things that I've seen, I don't know if they did more than one volume of it, but I know that they had Tatsunoko versus Capcom, kind of like how
right. Yeah, they had like a Tsukunoko fighter, and then like you're saying, yeah, I think at one point they had it versus Capcom, so like Ken could fight Ryu or, you know, whatever other characters from that company.
Right. And I've seen that, and I know that I've heard and seen a bit be another, but that's the only thing that's really hitting me across the face right now is the Capcom versus Tatsunoko. And then I got, okay, so, you know, for the kids out there, you know, I try to work a couple of comic book conventions throughout the years. And here locally, we have an annual kind of anime convention. And I worked that one just again, because it's local, I don't have to, you know, pay for hotel or, you know, travel or anything like that. And somebody at their table, and I, for the life of me, I mean, I could get up and go get it, but I don't want to right now because we're in the middle of the show. I want to say it was like this disc. It was like called Battle Royale or something along those lines, but it was basically like an anime version of Wacky Races. If you remember that.
Yeah.
Wacky Races. And so there was like already these characters that apparently were established through other shows, something like that. And so they were all in this competition every episode to go, and they were racing against each other in like these battle wagons or what the hell ever. I had no idea what I was getting into, but I saw the cover and I saw Ken the Eagle on the cover of this. And I'm like, okay, dude, how much do you want for this? Oh, it's like $5 for the DVD. I says, sold. Here's your $5. And so it was like this episode where the Wacky Racers somehow encounter like one of the Gatchaman characters. I can't remember off the top of my head. And they chase him down and they find like this sewer with a sewer lid with the Tatsunoko seahorse on it. And so they go in and then they have this tie-in with the Gatchaman characters. I mean, but it was like with this ridiculous campy, which I think is kind of typical with most Japanese comedy stuff, you know, very kind of over the top, you know, type of deals there. So I've definitely seen them make appearances in other shows, I guess is the short version of what I'm trying to say there.
Yeah. I'm sure I'm sure they have, and I'm sure they have a pretty large footprint on Japanese culture in general, like, because I think, as we've discussed, like, it seems like it's had its impact on things like Super Sentai and all kinds of stuff. So, but yeah, no, I mean, this is cool. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. I mean, I'm not upset that I spent time watching it, like, despite the criticisms or whatever, you know. I mean, I find this stuff kind of interesting to, you know, look at it from different vantage points. And again, I guess I should thank you too, because this is one of those things. You gave me an excuse to crack open the plastic on that bad boy, because I don't do that all the time. So I cracked open the plastic on that and popped it in the Blu-ray player, so that I'm always happy to have an excuse to do that as well. So I appreciate that. Well,
of course. No, and I mean, obviously I appreciate it anytime you want to have me on, you know, with anything with the panels. I'm always appreciative and will always take the time to show up and run my mouth. I would say, you know, I mean, in kind of like my final summation on this, I would say if for any of the listeners that haven't experienced or watched Gatchaman, this is like a nice sampler plate. Mm-hmm. You know, go to like, say, your Chinese buffet or whatever, and you want to have a little bit of the ragoon, and you want to have an egg roll here, and you want to have this to really kind of find out what it is you want to try. It's a nice little sampler plate buffet taste test type of a thing. And if you think it's something you really want to get into, so you get those nuances, it's really, really a good source to go with. I think a selection like later on that kind of goes through the same things, but does them their own way and might be a little, you know, even a little more palatable too, would be the OVAs that came out like in 94.
Oh, yeah. And those are included on that big box set that I have with the 105 episodes. I think there's like a bonus disc that has like extra stuff, and those OVAs are a part of it.
Yeah. And I mean, basically, they touch all three acts. That's the same three acts that you get here. But each one kind of gets a little more of its own time. And again, if that's something you check out, cool, great. But I will always be the one at the end of the day to be the end all be all day. Map out time throughout your schedule. You know, what are you, 20 minutes for an episode? Take some time, enjoy them, binge watch them, and just have fun with them. Because that's really, at the end of the day, that's what Gatchaman is. It's just fun. It's fun action adventure. You get your espionage, you get your superhero fix, you get your pre-Sentai stuff going on. Five acting as one, teen angst. Alien mutant shape-shifting hermaphrodites, if I'm allowed to say that on this show.
Yeah.
Craziness with the bird Katse and betrayal. And I mean, you touch on whether it's socioeconomic issues, religion. I mean, a lot of those episodes didn't ever make air in America when it came to stuff involving religion or you know, like I think the last three episodes never even made air in the US because they were just, there was too much. Seven's arc seven could only do so much. But yeah, no, I mean, it's a great fun series that's definitely worth the time to check out if you have the means.
Seven's arc seven's like, Joe's just sunbathing. He's fine. Back to you, Mark.
We just see him just blow a gasket. What was that? 2P4? Was that the red one that just like goes about and just blows the gas? That's what Seven's arc seven is doing during the last two episodes. Gotcha, man.
Red. All right. Well, if you guys have any comments, questions, and or concerns, you can email us at fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. You can find the backlog of episodes of Big in Japan over on fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. And we can be streamed. We're on all kinds of social media. We're on Tumblr, Twitter/X. We're on Facebook. You can leave us likes, hearts, retweets, all that good stuff. We appreciate it when you do. And we're on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and Amazon Music. So until the next time, this is going to be Derek WC, signing off.
And this is TJ, your tridentities are safe with me, signing off.
So, hip me to what you wanted to tell me about.
Well, first thing I was going to say is, did you see now? I've watched enough of the episodes. I know how to properly sign off on fan holes now.
Yeah.